HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 90, recorded live Wednesday, November 7th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with author and software architect Dan Appleman.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. We're sitting here in the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino with the legendary Dan Appleman. How are you today, sir?
I'm feeling particularly legendary today.
Fantastic. Fantastic. It must be difficult to walk around as a living legend. How would our listeners know you? What are some of your greatest hits?
My greatest hits, well, I go back to the old Visual Basic days in the component world. I wrote a number of books. One of them is the Win32 Guide, the Visual Basic Programmer's Guide to the Win32 API, and that was a big hit. Also moving to VB.net, and I'm also a co-founder of Apress, a publishing company. And currently, one of my big projects is I'm the webmaster of search.net.com, which is a custom search engine for .NET developers.
Ah, very cool. So this is filtering content, so then when you search for it, you're only getting the best editor-approved .NET content.
Right. It's a custom search engine specifically for .NET content, and the differences are really incredible in terms of what you can get. For example, one of the sessions I did today discussed failed software projects, and one of the people comes up and he asks, well, how would I find out some more case histories? And I say, well, you know, you can search for failed software projects, but if you search on search.net.com, you'll actually get .NET failed software projects, and you'll get information having to do with, I think he was also interested in performance. How would you do performance analysis and so on? I say, well, you would get .NET specific performance, and because we search all the dev sites and the MVP sites and expert sites, chances are you're going to get some pretty good information on the first page or two.
So it sounds like you have a pretty extensive whitelist of sites that's specifically only search within this domain or this subdomain.
It's reasonably extensive. It's less so than you'd think, because a lot of the sites you find are really just aggregators of other sites. And I try to stay away from that, because if you search across all the aggregators, you end up getting the same hit 20 different times, which, you know, doesn't really do you much good. Mm-hmm. So if you really look at the people who are generating original content, it's not quite as many as you'd think, but it's a fair amount.
And how would this compare to something like Google Blog Search? I mean, certainly I feel like the most compelling content is sitting on blogs. Are you picking blogs on a one-by-one basis, or are you saying, like, I want all of weblogs.asp.net?
Both. So I'll go to weblogs.asp.net. I'll go to the Microsoft Dev blogs, MSDN blogs. But I will absolutely get individual sites, MVP sites and so on. I think your site's on there too, in fact.
Very good. Search.net.com.
Yeah, search.net.com, one word.
Cool. Now, do you do any consulting these days? I mean, are you an independent?
I do a fair amount of consulting. Say half and half. I really almost do it for fun, just to sort of keep my eye in it. And I do a lot of it because my sister's become a really amazing web architect. She's one of those people who will go into a company and give them the website that they actually need, not the one they're asking for. And those are really two very different things. She can come in and she will find out about their business. She'll find out about their brand, if necessary, help them develop the brand. And then only after she's really figured out what they're trying to accomplish will she actually go ahead and tell them, you know, adjust what they wanted to what is really going to work for them. And I do a lot of her back-end work. So I'm the software architect to actually design and implement some of the solutions she comes up with.
So you're acting as a single architect, kind of a one-person, one-architect shop. What kind of challenges are there as opposed to being a team of architects or the member of a larger enterprise architecture group?
Well, that actually was the subject of this morning's talk, because one of the things I came to realize is that a lot of the talk about software architecture is focused towards the enterprise. right? And you think about teams of software developers, and you think about the software architect whose job it is to manage the developers and create the specifications and develop the requirements and all of that. And that's great if it's an enterprise and mm-hmm. they know what a software architect is. They have the money for a software architect and they get it. And admittedly, even a lot of the large company projects fail, but still at least we sort of know what they need. Mm-hmm. But what about the small businesses? What about the small organizations, the one-person shop or the small business or the startup company where they're busy focusing on the product? They need a website right away. Mm-hmm. They don't have the resources to do it. Mm-hmm. Who's going to do it for them? What about even larger companies where the product team is, again, developing the product and the website or an IT project comes to the one poor marketing person IT manager who suddenly has to have something, that's really a small business. And what they'll do is they'll go out and hire a consultant and they'll get garbage.
Mm.
And one of the main reasons they get garbage is because they're asking for garbage. They don't have a software architect. They don't know what to ask for. So part of my message is to help the small shops, the individual developers, people who are brought in to develop a solution, to realize they need to do the architecture as well. They need to be software architects as well.
So let me see if I can understand, kind of paraphrasing. You're saying that in a smaller organization, when you don't have all that support structure that a larger enterprise architecture organization would have, that the general responsibilities of an architect start to kind of bleed into the roles of the other members of that smaller team, and everyone has to kind of take up that architectural...
Sometimes the small team is one person or two people. And one of the things that I see over and over again is that a company will go and they'll go out and try to get something done. They need a solution. And the project is a disaster. They are taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. It's shocking, the degree.
So what are the root causes of that? I mean, break it down to why do we see that so often? Why is it so easy to have that happen? Fewer people are involved. You would think with fewer people, the communication would be better.
You would think so. But one of the studies I looked at, a KPMG study, showed that by their definition, about 60% of small projects, any project under 12 months, they describe, fails. It's either way over budget or way past deadline or just doesn't meet the requirements. And there are a number of reasons for it. One is there are some consultants who, frankly, are unethical. They are not thinking about the best interests of the company. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll find out, well, what's your budget for it? Oh, $50,000. Okay, we can spend $50,000. Right? You see that.
It's
terrible. And one of the points in my session is that a software developer has an ethical responsibility towards the client. You know, our job is to act in the best interests of the client. And I think a lot of people don't do that. Another thing that happens is that, and this is pretty common, the software developer gives the customer what they ask for. Problem is that the customer doesn't know what they want.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy about this earlier. One of my bosses used to say that a customer walks in and he says, this cell phone needs a bigger antenna. And then ultimately you have to dig into the issue of, this person wants better cell phone reception. They may have come in with their proposed solution, which may very well be a larger antenna, but it could be any one of a dozen different issues. So often the customer will come with a solution.
Right. And their solution's wrong. One example that I saw is, again, this was a website. The customer said, I want a CMS. I want a content management solution. I say, okay, well, why? We want to be able to edit the site. Okay, well, that's reasonable. Tell us about the site. How often does it change? Oh, well, it's not really going to change. You know, occasionally it might change. I say, okay, who's going to be doing this content? Well, I don't really know who's going to be making the changes. And after talking and finding out, we came to realize that they didn't want a CMS system at all. They wanted a site they could occasionally change. So we ended up putting them on a static HTML site and hooking them up with Contribute so that they could hire a high school student to go ahead and edit those occasional things that needed editing.
But of course, no customer would come and say, I want a static HTML site. That would never be the solution that they would propose, even though that may be the one that they truly needed in the end.
Sure, because they thought, they'd heard that a CMS system is what allows you to edit your site and handle it.
Exactly.
But by doing that, by keeping them on a static HTML site, we gave them a solution that's incredibly secure, very stable, excellent performance, can be edited to suit their needs, doesn't have to be updated with periodic security patches. It was exactly, and we saved them a ton of money.
Yeah.
You know, but not only immediately in the short term, but in the long run.
And presumably pass that savings on to them.
Of course.
As opposed to doing a fixed bid and keeping it all for yourself.
Of course. I mean, I have an advantage because consulting is a sideline for me.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't need the work. So I have a real freedom in terms of really trying to save the customer money. And that's what I enjoy doing. I like to find a solution that really is reliable, stable, inexpensive, all those good things.
I think that's a real challenge, though, for the independent consultant who does need the money. You know, if you need to hit the mortgage that month, and you also need to be ethical and provide the best possible experience for the client. One of the discussions I was having yesterday at dinner was a gentleman said, well, what if you spend many, many years building up your consultancy as a single individual, building frameworks? And those frameworks enable you to deliver things faster and faster and faster. Maybe you're billing at it $100 an hour, but you realize that a particular client could make great use of your framework, and that might save them the equivalent of 40 hours, 80 hours. Do you bill for what you would call value-added billing, which is hours not done, but hours that they would have had to have paid because you created this framework? Do you raise your hourly rate? Or do you simply pass the savings on to them and say that this is why you should continue to do business with me?
Well, what I personally do in cases like that is, you know, again, my background is that of a component vendor. So I componentize it. So there are a number of pieces that are, yes, and you know, we're going to charge you the hourly rate and $150 for this component.
Hmm. So the formalization of that framework, rather than simply having a collection of utilities and base classes that you've got kind of in your pocket, draw a dotted line around those and draw up a licensing agreement, give it a name, and say, this is the component we're going to license to you.
Absolutely. So everybody wins. The customer gets the benefit of the amortized price of the component, the fact that you're able to reuse it. You get to sell a product, not just time. It's a win-win situation for everybody. And it's perfectly ethical because it's all above board.
I wonder if that would be harder. I would think with these micro ISVs, because it seems like a lot of one man or one woman consultancy shops also have a micro ISV kind of a bent. And you have a certain split brain issue where you're trying to act as a consultant, but you'd really like to get these other electrons out for sale because electrons are cheaper to sell than molecules. You know?
Well, have you read by any chance The World is Flat?
Yeah, I have, actually.
So really what we're talking about is what you describe a micro ISV. It's how do you stay relevant and how do you stay effective as a consultant in a world where you're competing against Rent-A-Coder, you know, these guys in Bangalore who will do things for $100. And the value that we provide is not in the coding. It is really in the software architecture. It is in the ability to really talk to the customer, find out what they really need, give them an effective solution. That's something that's really, really hard to do from Bangalore. Right. And that's the advantage we have. And,
of course, some of our listeners, of course, listening to this in Bangalore.
That's fine. So, you know what? This is what you need to do.
Componentize your solutions.
Componentize your solutions and feel comfortable really finding out what your customer needs. If you can find out, if you can solve the customer's problem, save the money, you will make up in referrals more than what you would lose in the one project.
Well, that's interesting. I just had this phrase pop into my head, architecting for referrals. Just thinking that as a software architect, there's so many competing things that you need to balance, right? I mean, the job of an architect, a software architect, is definitely one of juggling.
When you look at, you say, what is a software architect doing? I looked at some of the definitions, and what it really comes down to is we're the people who prevent projects from failing. Right? I mean, that's the job of a software architect because so many projects do fail. In fact, if you compare software architecture to other kinds of architecture, you know, we're here in Mandalay Bay, and I got to tell you, if the construction, the building architects had the same track record as software architects, I would not feel comfortable in the 16th floor of this hotel. You know, I was like, there's a 20% chance of what? So, you know, we're talking about preventing things from failing. Well, why do software projects fail? It's not the technology. It's not the coding. Software projects fail because of people issues. They fail because of failure to get good requirements or to get the incorrect requirements. They are inadequate training of the software developers. It's poor design. These are what cause software projects to fail, poor management.
You bring up design, and I have noticed a lot of people, and I've been guilty of this myself, using the word architecture and design interchangeably.
No, design is part of architecture.
Okay, a subset.
It's a subset. A software architect is concerned with the entire software lifecycle. And we're trying to come up with a solution. First of all, we have to define what are the requirements? What does the customer really, truly need? Okay. Then, what are the designs? What are the approaches, the architectures, if you will, for solving that problem? Then there's the actual specification, so actually formalizing it.
When you're doing a small project, how do you like to do your specifications? I understand that a lot of people who do one-man, two-man shops like to do, like, you know, the code is the spec, or the tests are the spec. They use specifications like NSpec or RSpec. Sometimes they'll use screenshots. They'll point at that and say, well, that mock-up is the spec. Is a spec prose, as far as you're concerned?
I like prose. I'm a writer. So for me, the spec is prose. The two big parts of the spec, there's the feature list, and that might include, you know, some graphics and so on. It might be just a bulleted list. In plain English, right, or whatever language you're coding in, something that the user can actually understand.
Sounds like user stories, people would say, in the Agile community.
Here's what you're getting, right? Then there's the non-feature list. These are things you're not getting, and that's more important.
The negative space.
Yes, because when the customer who isn't going to read the spec anyway, right, is barely going to understand it, they sort of assume they've told you what they want, so they're going to assume that it's in the feature list. But when you say, here's what you're not getting, they might actually pay attention to that. And it might cause them to step back and say, oh, hold on a minute. I want that, or I need that. What would it cost me? It also is sort of good in terms of covering yourself, in terms of when they come back later and say, here's why isn't this here? Say, look, it's in the list of things that I wasn't going to do, right? It's the list of things that you can't have unless you spend more money, right? So the non-feature list, and this is it's good from a design perspective because you're also thinking when you get around to designing. It's like, okay, where are my limitations? What doors am I closing in this design? Things that are going to become very hard to do later because of a design decision I make now.
See, that's very interesting. I think that from my point of view, that there's a big difference. There's an explicit difference between simply the list of stuff you're not getting versus the things that this design precludes.
And that is the critical part because when you preclude something, it becomes really, really expensive to add it later. So you want to get a handle on that as a software architect because now is the time when you have to consider the future. As a software architect, you want to consider not just what they want now. You want to consider anything they might ever possibly want because now's the cheapest time to put those hooks in to make it possible
right.
And to make the architecture enable that.
Right.
So I'm really big on asking the customer question, are you ever, ever in your wildest dreams going to want this?
Exactly. And this is a load-bearing wall.
Yes.
And if we knock it down, it's going to cause destabilization of the entire structure.
Yeah. So my specs include a fair amount of you know, if you're ever going to want this, it's going to cost you this much to make it possible someday later.
Certainly, yeah, it certainly costs money to, and I'm mixing my metaphors now, but sometimes the customer wants to have their finger on the chess piece before they make that move, and they just won't take their finger off the piece and commit to that move.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just don't know that I might want that. And then you get into, you know, risk mitigation. It's like, how risky is it if we take this direction or that direction?
And that's what a lot of the spec is. It's, you know, what are the risks? What are the approaches? What are the trade-offs? You know, you can go this way, you can go this way. That's software architecture. The coding's the easiest part. That, you know, I don't even do a lot of the coding. I'll find other people to do coding.
Right. In that context, the coding is the transcription.
Right.
If you have correctly taken their business need and written it into a spec, then coding is just the transcription of that.
Right. We're also very concerned about long-term maintenance, support. What are they going to do when you leave? Right. One horror story, I actually saw this. I was looking at Renacoder because I wanted to get familiar with it. This was somebody was requesting a job to unzip a file. It seems like all of their source code had been built by this consultant and they had zipped up the source code, they password protected it, and they'd left.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
That was source control for them.
Right. And they didn't have any access to the code. And of course, nowadays, depending on which zip technology you use, some of them are really very, very secure. Mm-hmm. And I have total sympathy. And I'm actually, the tragedy is that the lack of ethics on the part of the software developer who didn't make it, you know, give them the product they bought,
right?
Basically. And it's tragic when that happens. And I've seen a number of cases where that happens, and it's unacceptable.
Because ultimately that individual didn't know what they were receiving, and they may not have been educated enough to know that they did in fact need that code.
It could be, but the software developer's responsibility is to make, I mean, we have a responsibility to make sure that somebody can follow us and support the code.
Yeah, that's actually true in open source projects as well. We had an interesting discussion this morning in the open source panel at about 8 this morning, and the comment came up that, well, what if the entire project team is hit by a bus? Or, you know, we're unable to get something, to get help, to get support on this because it's old. We all kind of refer to that kind of canonical project that we've all stumbled upon on the net that looks really interesting, but, you know, it hasn't been updated since 2003, and that was like 50 years ago, and I don't really feel comfortable. And then when you unzip it, and you can't say, with some projects, you can't just say build.bat. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I've worked at companies where we've put source code into escrow. And, you know, to protect the client. But ultimately, we all knew that there was no way that they would ever be able to get the kind of Rube Goldbergian build system that we had put together in order to make this thing build. So while it gave them comfort that this source was in escrow, certainly they weren't enabled to actually do anything about it.
It's actually funny because, Deswar, with our software company, one of the things we did was, a large portion of our code, we didn't make it open source, but we opened the source. We made the source code available to our customers. So it's not like open source.
Source opened.
And the reason we did that is we wanted to make sure that all of our customers, even though, you know, we've been around for since 91, which is an eternity, and we still will support and ship stuff from back then.
I mean, really? Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
that's quite a statement.
Well, we believe that software's life cycles are as long as the customer needs them. But we also realized that that can't go on forever. So we opened up the source, and one of the projects we had was, okay, let's make sure this can be built. And, you know, one of the techniques that we make sure we can build our own software is that we don't upgrade machines. We replace machines. So I have literally a rack of machines that are build systems for old software.
Wow.
So we can go back and rebuild stuff. Now, of course, that's much better because you have virtual machines.
Sure, yeah. I actually have a Windows 98 virtual machine that I use to sync my Newton because I couldn't get my Newton to work in 64-bit Vista. Don't know why. It seems like a reasonable scenario.
Our accounting software runs on Windows ME.
Inside of a VM?
Inside of a VM.
Fantastic.
Right. So virtual machines really go a long way to solving that particular problem, for which I'm incredibly grateful.
Yeah. That's a great idea. I think of the metaphor of if you've got a classic car in the garage, you really need to make sure that car gets turned on every couple of months. And I like the idea of the formalization of that. Let's just make sure we build everything, you know, a couple of times a year to make sure that something hasn't rotted.
Right. The real problem with building our old stuff, you know, for someone getting our source is actually not going to be our code. It's going to be that they're going to have to get a copy of, you know, Visual Basic 3.0 or Visual C++ 5.1 or whatever version was the fixed build version. Because, you know, when we upgrade to newer versions of the software, the new version gets built on the latest C++, but we don't go ahead and back build old versions. I mean, that would be a lot of time for no purpose.
Right. Do you have any formalization? This is a little bit off topic, but I was just thinking about configuration management because you're talking about how the architect's job is the entire life cycle of the software. And a friend of mine, Adam Kogan, had an application that he shipped. And when you go to the Help About menu, he actually shipped NUnit, the GUI, with his application so that you could run all of his unit tests on the client machine. And some people thought this was madness, and I thought this was just about the coolest thing ever, that he would basically let the user run a complete suite of unit tests, the same one he runs, and then send the results to them in order to see the health of this. And it was kind of a clever poor man's configuration management system. And then they ended up building that into a larger diagnostic tool, such that if any client is having trouble with their machine, you download this thing, check the status quo, and kind of upload it to them in order to see if version numbers.
Well, now of course you're talking about a completely different subject, which is instrumenting software for most systems. And, you know, nowadays, for all of our .NET development, we instrument the application. So it's full of, you know, trace sources and so on. And you can turn them on and off using the config file and dump tons of information and capture it and have them send it to you. Mm-hmm. So, yes, writing software, instrument your application.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that was a little bit of a tangent, but I was just thinking that those are the kinds of things that I've seen. It's funny. I've seen more of those kinds of techniques in one and two man software shops than in large enterprises.
Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for the one and two man software shop. You yourself mentioned it earlier. It does cut down the communication costs. You don't necessarily have to create a complex formal specification because you're not splitting up the work among a dozen developers. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that you wouldn't want to do a complex formal specification for a small project that of this scale anyway, because nobody's ever going to read it. I mean, they don't read the documentation anyway. They don't read the specifications anyway.
Well, they're there for when they don't get what they want. They refer back to it to make sure, because they think of I think the most average business person thinks of a software specification as being a pretty clear contract, pretty clear right. relationship between the architect and them.
Right. One of the things that that I do that I don't know how common this is, but I think it's really important, is we'll often do a proposal to do the proposal. I've seen a lot of proposals. People go out and say, we need this, and the proposals come back, and most of them are garbage. And the reason they're garbage is because in order to really quote a project, in order to do a proper proposal, you really have to have a lot of the design and requirements already done. Otherwise, you're just guessing.
So it sounds to me like you're pretty clear to charge them for that, even if you don't end up doing the final work.
If it's substantial, yeah, absolutely. So we'll come in and we'll find out your requirements. We'll find out your current status. We'll figure out what you need. We'll come up with not a full software specification, but at least a general architecture, recommendations of technologies to use and so on. And then, you know, we can build it for you or you can get it. Sometimes we don't even want to build it. We'll say, I'm not a consulting firm.
That's true. I mean, how often have you done that? Have you gone in beginning the step zero, the request for a proposal, and then said, after an appropriate vetting, you know, I don't think I'm interested in this business?
Sometimes I'll go in even from the beginning. I say, this is not the kind of job that I'll do, but I know what you need done. Mm-hmm. We'll go ahead. We'll do the requirements. We'll do the give you a direction. And we'll even help you review the proposals and help you choose someone.
I think that's a really valuable skill that the average individual consultant out there, for those who think that they are a coder, could be, you know, begin to get an understanding of architecture and open up a whole new practice, a whole new potential source of revenue, acting as an architect, as a bridge between the business and the technical.
Well, here's the interesting thing about it. It's not rocket science. I mean, you don't have to go to architecture school to do this, right?
The way the Software Architects Act, you'd think that it was kind of a mystery.
No, it's really not. It's really more of a choice. It's a willingness to look at this stuff. The problem is a lot of coders aren't interested. They say, tell me what to do and I'll build it, right? And what it takes is a certain mindset. It's just a decision to say, you know, I want to come up with the right solution for this customer and I will look at everything and talk to anyone to come up with that right solution. I guess once you've built enough software, you're ready to go ahead and try that. And certainly once you've seen enough nightmares, and that's how I think software architects learn at this level, is you look at horror stories and you figure out and you see what's gone wrong and you say, I can do that. I can talk to people. I can ask questions. It's a choice. It's not a science.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule here at Dev Connections at the Mandalay Bay. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.